Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time, the season's past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score, which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing Broadcasting Network, in conjunction with Swick Enterprises, and we're live. Southport, North Carolina home, Gridiron Greats Magazine, Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history, memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You'll find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host, the senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Always good to be back. Always good. Best seat in the house, football with Gaffin.
We are back with another show, and we're going to get right into our warm-up before our special guest comes on, and we're going to talk a little bit about the 1954 Bowman football card set of 120 cards. Joe, I'll hand off to you, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, the 1954 Bowman, Bob and I are working our way through the sets, having brief discussion before our guests come on. And as we've mentioned before, the 1954 Bowman is the redheaded stepchild of the Bowman, the Bowman Company. 48 Bowman black and white, 50 Bowman beautiful little squares, 51 Bowman, amazing gray color, 52 Bowman, literally the most collected set in football. If you read that, that article I wrote for Gridiron about a year ago, the most popular sets, you'd know the 52 Bowman large is the most collected set. 53 Bowman is one of my favorites. I think just really good looking colors, really good action scenes. And then they took their foot off the gas a little bit to me. Maybe they saw the writing on the wall. Maybe they felt a lot of pressure from tops. But 54 and 55 just kind of became a little more blasé to me. I don't know. Maybe my expectations are really high because of, 51, 52, 53. But, yeah, 54 Bowman. You can find a PSA card. A PSA 8 card of it for $50, but 128 cards in the set, one sheet. pretty basic. Packed full of Hall of Famers. That's one thing it does have, but only one Hall of Fame rookie card. The card number 23, the George Blanda. That's his rookie card. I like 55 Bowman. There just weren't that many rookie cards. But rookie cards have just, in the last 15 years, become popular. Before that, people were aware of rookie cards, but I think they've become a lot more coveted lately, rookie cards. Because I can remember trading away half of my 1984 top set to a guy for a 1976 O.J. Simpson record breaker card. It wasn't even his rookie card. So,
wow.
The Blanda, number four.
Ouch.
Yeah, I remember I carried him in my lunch pail with a rubber band around him. But
the
124 cards. Go ahead.
I got to say this. 128 cards. Now, this is my general comment on it. They did boost from 96 cards in the 53 set up to 128 cards. And, again, they went back from the 52s, which I believe had 144 cards in them. So they cut way back in 53. 54, they came back a little. And I had a pretty rough time putting this set together way back when I did put it together. Because there was just not a lot of them out there. I saw more 55 Bowmans out there. And as I said in previous shows, I saw more 51s and 52s. 54, for whatever reason, I had a rough time finding some of the cards on it. And re-looking at the set today, this afternoon before the show, my set is pretty much a strong DGEX, with the exception of about six cards that need really serious upgrading. But it's interesting, according to my notes, my toughest card that I had difficulty finding was card number 71 of Art DiCarlo of the Steelers. And that's one of the cards that needs upgrading. Yeah, I don't know why I had such a tough time, but I got a pretty beater of a card for card 71 there. But anyways, tough set, very difficult for me back then to put it together. Today, obviously, much easier. And to just make a quick comment, what you were saying about rookies, I think the big key is back then when I was putting the set together, and my Blanda is not that bad. It's probably BG condition. Putting that set together, people were more concerned putting the set together. They weren't concerned with a rookie or not rookie, or putting their team set together. Whereas today, the fixation is on a rookie card and get it in PSA 10 or whatever type of thing. So it's kind of interesting to see, the variance between those years going 40 years back plus. And actually, I started the set probably in 1978, 79. And going back to the 80s, the glory years, tough to find. Really tough to find to piece it together.
Yeah, well, quick trivia for you. If 1954 is George Blanda's rookie card, what was the last card that you can get in a mainstream set of George Blanda?
It's either 75 or 76.
You are spot on. That's why you're the captain, and I'm the co-host. 1970 tops. I'm looking at it right now, and man, is he an old man. He looks like my dad sitting on that bench, moved on to become a kicker. That's funny you mentioned that card is your toughest one to get. I put this set together in PSA 8 10 years ago, and the toughest one was the John Lattner, card number 128. And everyone knows, I'm an avid key collector. From Near Mint Mike's website, the John Lattner, these were printed in numerical order. So the John Lattner is the lower right card on the sheet. And always these cards, all the corner cards get beat up. So it went against, left side went against the rail, the right side, had the cutting edge. So it just got beat up. So would imagine the card 64. Oops.
It's interesting. I'm looking at my Lattner card, and it's not bad. I got a couple of minor creases on it, but it's definitely slightly off center. It's definitely not a clean cut one way or the other. So that does, confirm. And you are the sheet expert, it does confirm where that card laid in the sheet itself. Okay. What was the other card you were saying, 64?
Oh, I was going to say 64 would be the...
Card 64, Ray Renfro.
Yeah, Ray Renfro. It's so funny. We always, I always end up with a little bit of, some of these, we end up with, questions where we're just like, wow, what about, I usually do the show in my office, so I have, notes and stuff in front of me, and I have access to my computer. I don't know how many times I've looked stuff up on, while you and I are talking, just because, sometimes I end up with more questions where it's like, yeah, what is that? How is the sheet laid out? What is George Blanda's last card? I didn't know that. You did. So.
Cool. That's cool. But again, I really think, in today's day and age, it's almost a no-brainer. There is really no difficult set to put together if you are looking for a particular condition besides gem mint or graded or whatever the case may be. But if you want to put in a base, put together a basic set of 1954 Bowman, it is very doable one way or the other. And to me, the whole run of Bowmans are very doable one way or the other. And we've said that in the past also, but again, we've been going step by step with the Bowmans. We've been going step by step looking at it each year. I always liked the, with the exception of the 48 Bowman set, I've always liked the Bowmans. I just think there's something about them that are neat. And I always thought to myself, they were limited with regards to only being around from 48 to 55. And, it's classic vintage football that you're looking at. And it's nice to see. It's nice to view. And getting back to another comment about the National, I had bought several early Bowmans that I had from inventory, and I had one collector basically bought every one I had to finish his set, and he just said it's so tough to find Bowmans right now ungraded. He seemed like a very basic collector. He was collecting VG type cards and was more concerned putting the set together. So that's interesting to me. Eventually the set collector will die. But at the same time, I really believe that, it's really being overlooked to not collect the vintage set or, several vintage sets or a run of Bowman's, let's say, in ungraded, in an ungraded manner and just enjoy them. Look at them and view them and enjoy the history of them at the same time.
It's like picking your favorite kid. Where you're like, oh, I love the Bowmans. There's a couple I don't like. But then it's like, yeah, I really like you saying, I really like the Bowmans. I was like, yeah, so do I. And then I'm like, man, I really dig the 53 set. But the 50 set was my favorite to collect. I have all four uncut sheets of that. But then immediately my mind wandered. I'm like, but I like that 56 top set. 57 is one of my favorite sets. Man, that 58, you can't go wrong. Boy, don't even get me started on the Fleers. I love the 61 Fleers. And literally in that 3 seconds, I started running through them all. I made it all the way up to 1970 before I'm like, out of hell with it. I love football cards.
I mean, I hear you. And again, my era is 60, so I can look at, every day without hesitation and never get bored looking at 60 to 69 top, 60 to 63 Fleer, and 64 to 67 Phillies. To me, they're just classic vintage cards, and you can't go wrong with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a nice collectible. And again, looking at these Bowmans this afternoon, it's been a nice trip down memory lane for me. Brought back a lot of memories collecting, and again, also showed me how many cards I really need to try to upgrade. But I'm not overly concerned about that one way or the other, because when I was buying these, as you well know, I bought the number. I was not overly concerned what kind of grade it was in. And I never imagined back in the early 80s buying a card and saying, gee, I hope this gets, graded a 10 or whatever. Because there was no grading factor. So that was
I was talking to another, you know, hobbyist the other day, and I was literally telling them, I'm like, when I traded away my 1984, you know, like 50 1984 cards for that 76, you know, OJ record breaker, that OJ was in bad shape. It wasn't, it was just, I want an OJ card, you know, not, you know, we weren't considered with, we weren't concerned with, you know, quality, et cetera. At what point was somebody like, you know, we should really, you know, at what point did centering, you know, corners and stuff like that become very important? Was that when, you know, in the advent of grading, or were, if you go back in your memory, were people always like, well, what's the centering look like? How are the corners? Is that where the very good, you know, VG, you know, mint grade, stuff like that, is that where that came along?
Well, yeah. I mean, it became very prevalent once 1989 hit, when Score came out and ProSec came out, and everybody started, you know, started getting really condition sensitive for older cards. And I would always try to explain to them, listen, you know, they were not handled with ease back in the 50s and 60s. They were used. You picked them up, you touched them, you read them, you looked at them, you played with them, and that was it. You know, you didn't put them away knowing that, you know, 50 years from now, you know, you were going to get them graded and they're going to be worth thousands of dollars. You know, it's a hobby.
Yeah.
It's fun type of thing. So, you know, the whole market evolved 32 years from basically 1989 to now, that everything is conditioned. So fine, let it be conditioned. I'm not overly concerned with condition, you know.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to. All right, our special guest is here, and I'd like to introduce him to our audience tonight. Our special guest this evening started doing card shows as a dealer back in 1986 when he was only 14 years old. Unlike many of his contemporaries, he always had an interest in older cards and so survived the crash of the late 1980s and early 90s material that eliminated many small dealers. He's a recipient of the Dick Henry Scholarship to the RACC Auctioneering Program, where he graduated in May 2017. His current house, auction house, is Collector Connection. He is a Newsom advertiser to Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'd like to welcome to our show this evening, Mr. Scott Russell. Scott, welcome to the show.
No, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on.
Did you hear me?
Oh, yeah.
We can hear you.
Okay.
It was nice meeting you. Nice meeting you at the National also, and we were able to talk
Absolutely.
Very briefly. So I'm going to lead off by asking you, please tell our audience how you got started on being a dealer and auction house owner.
Yeah, two different stories, as you can imagine. I can remember at about 13 years old, I was at the local card shop, and they had a copy of something called Baseball Card Magazine, which I had never heard of before. And so I got it, and I said, and there was a price guide in it. I went, well, these things are worth something besides what the guy at the store says? And in there was the Wade Boggs rookie card was selling for $13 or something at the time. And I'm like, I have 20 of those. So I thought I was rich. And you were talking about when condition became important. I brought my 20 Wade Boggs rookies to that card store. And he said, well, yeah, but these are all beat up. And so that's when condition became a thing for me. And a couple short years later was setting up at the mall shows and everything else with my brother, doing card shows as a dealer.
Interesting.
And how it became
that?
An auction was I was working, I'd say a regular job, but I actually worked in live theater. So that wasn't really all that regular. But I decided I wanted to work for myself, and I was going to go back to being a dealer full-time. I had the part-time eBay store like a lot of people do and whatnot. And the owner of a live auction that I attended mentioned that he was looking to retire and maybe sell the business. And in Pennsylvania, you have to be a licensed auctioneer. And I said, well, if you're willing to wait for me to go to school and get my license, I'll buy the business from you. And so kind of took a bit of a turn from my original plan, which was just to be a full-time dealer, and became an auctioneer instead.
Huh.
Wow.
What? First of all, Scott, thanks for being on the show. This is Joe.
Oh, thank you.
What year was that you went to a dealer with your Wade Boggs and said, hey.
It would have been like 1985. It was about a year before we started actually dealing ourselves then.
Okay. That's pretty funny because I have a very fond memory of buying a Beckett and then at one point literally laying in my stomach in my room with a piece of paper running through the cards going, oh, my gosh, that's worth this. That's worth
that. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you were rich. Like, you thought that book was wrong.
Worth cards. I never really went to a store and went, you know, where's my $200? You know,
yeah, here's my card. Where's my money? The book says so.
That's awesome. I love it. Well, that's cool. I always love hearing how people started. And I mean, and so that auction house you bought or took over, what was the mm-hmm. name of that? Is that called
Birmingham Auctioneers. That was the name of the owner. And it was live-only auctions in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I continued to do live auctions for a while, but we also added online. We kept the two completely separate, but we did both styles. And then when the pandemic hit, it forced us completely online and also kind of drove home the point that as a business model, it's a much better business.
Got it. Well,
so I do miss actually getting up and bid calling, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I really got back into the hobby when eBay was a thing. So it makes me laugh to hear people talking about where you faxed in your bids or you called in and bumped it up.
Yeah. Even mail order bids.
That's kind of cool. But, hey, I wanted to personally thank you for helping me register for your auction. I'm pretty sure that was user error with my zip code bogging down. But thank you.
You're not unique. Don't feel bad.
If you personally helping me register for the auction is any indication of the customer service that you give at Collectors Connection, I'm sure you'll be incredibly successful. Just thank you for personally registering me.
Sure. Basically, if somebody has a problem, they wind up getting me on the phone. So.
Right on. That was just really cool. I really appreciated it. Because I'm pretty sure it was, you know, user error, but. I went back and looked at the previous auction you had. It looked really good. You had some good stuff. You mentioned your future auction's not yet posted, but, I'm asking this for our listeners, but most of them are going to be asked if there's any Steve Largent cards in there, and if you could talk about Largent cards in your next coming auction and or any other, you know, football cards of note that would be coming up.
Well, we actually had an auction start last night. That's in what we call live preview, which means we're still updating, adding images, tweaking descriptions, fixing typos, that kind of thing. We do that on Sunday, and then it runs for 2 weeks as a completed listing. But there is a live auction up right now, and there's a lot of it has pictures, but there's a lot to go yet. So for the football guys, we have a nice little run of Joe Montana rookies and everything from like 6 through 8. But then tons of raw cards. Actually, I'm looking at a raw lot right now. It's an 81 Kellen Winslow, 86 Steve Young, 86 Bruce Smith, and some guy named Largent from 77, it looks like. So that might be a rookie.
Yes.
This is one of our general post-war auctions, not a real football theme to it, so there's not a ton of football in this one. The big one coming up is our next auction, which has a heavy football theme and has some real interesting, heavy-hitting type stuff.
Right. Because, this is gridiron greats. I mean, the idea here is to give you the GG.
Yeah, sorry, the other story was the Wade Boggs story. I could have changed it, I guess. But
to protect the innocent, that's okay. We're slightly aware of that that game with a round white ball and a stick.
With that stick,
Well, outstanding. Any Largent or any auction with a Largent card, just brings it into that next stratosphere of excellence. So well done. Very cool. And is that you said it was kind of a double secret probation, viewing right now? Is that available on your website or is that by
invite
only?
Yeah, thecollectorconnection.com. And like I said, it just kicked off at 10:00 last night. So. You'll find a lot of holes in it still, but there's a lot of stuff already ready to go. And you can bid now.
Sure. Well, we could probably have an entire podcast on how hard it is to upload stuff to to an auction site and just the beta testing that goes on it and just, hitting send where it's like, okay, this is live, and then discovering, misspellings, typos, et cetera.
We spell check because we do it via a database, and we spell check the database before we send it and still find mistakes. You know, it drives you crazy.
Oh, man, that's pretty cool. Yeah, just a whole nother level of, you know, making that public, because you've seen threads on, you know, vintage football where it's just like, you know, hey, this card is trimmed, you know, hey, this, it's just, it's interesting. It's once you put it out to our very finicky, you know, football card collecting public, it's,
And that actually reminds me of kind of a good thing, you know, an important thing to say about us, too, you know, when you talk about customer service. We have a great ability guarantee. If you buy a raw card from us, we guarantee it is capable of receiving a number grade, regardless of whether, let me get that straight. It'll get a number grade, and unless we say in the listing it is trimmed, it is colored, it is blah, blah, blah. So if you buy a raw card from us, you can rest assured that we think it's capable of getting a grade unless we say it.
Okay, so...
And that process, you actually submit the card through us, because obviously we can't, you know, mail the card to you, and then, you know, you tell me 6 months later that, you know, it didn't grade. We actually take care of the submission process and everything, but you even get your grading fees back if we fail, because we feel it's our job to be right.
Interesting. So if you, in the description, say this is a mint, or, you know, near mint...
we don't guarantee the number.
Oh, got
you. I'm not promising you a 7. I'm just promising you that nothing we sell has been altered.
Oh, got you. That makes sense. Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah, no, that is, yeah. I have guts, and I'm pretty good at grading, but I don't know if I have that much guts.
Oh, yeah, no, without a doubt. And if it was true, then, you know, you'd send it off. No, totally.
Yeah, it's good to have because, again, you know, a lot of, unfortunately, in the hobby over the years, so there's a lot of trim cards that are being sold.
And innocently a lot of times. You know, it's not always something nefarious.
Yeah, good point.
Yep.
But you know, like I said, we feel it's our job to be the expert in the room, and if we blow it, you shouldn't have to pay for it.
That's really cool. How many other auction houses do that, just kind of put the guarantee there? You know,
there's not a ton of auction houses out there selling raw, period.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very true.
Or even just to have their time to put their eye on every card. That means you're going through every card in every auction with a discerning.
And then either my brother or myself doing all the grading at this point. So
interesting. Good for you.
It's good.
That's awesome.
Looks good.
Scott, I'm curious. What, in your opinion, has been the top five football items you've handled over the years or auctioned off since you've gone into business or prior to that?
I was thinking about that. There's always two different approaches. There's like, well, what's the most expensive thing you've sold, which is what a lot of people want to know. But I'm more interested in the stuff that I found interesting because, you know, obviously I see a lot of stuff. And so I kind of went with the five most interesting things we've had.
Oh, cool.
We had the Dixie Lid Bronco Nagurski in an 8.5.
Oh, my God.
And,
wow.
Yeah, you know, it was not a cheap item, but it's not a bank breaker by any stretch of the imagination. But what blew my mind was it's probably the only Dixie lid I've ever seen where the tab hadn't been folded. The little tab to lift it out of the ice cream cup didn't have that crease like they all have. And no ice cream staining on the back. I almost think that somebody found an unused lid somewhere because it was the cleanest thing I'd ever seen.
Then we have a funny one for item number two.
We had a Cliff Branch autograph. You know, that's not that big a deal, but what it was kind of hilarious. It was a letter from Cliff Branch to an autograph seeker explaining why he didn't sign autographs through the mail without a donation to charity, signed by Cliff Branch.
Signed by Cliff Branch.
And authenticated. So he wrote a letter to a guy telling him why he wouldn't sign his autograph for him and signed the letter.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's one of my all-time favorite just because it's hilarious.
That is the irony of that. It's funny.
Yeah. And then we had one of my personal favorite. I'm a Giant fan. So it's oddly a personal favorite because it's a Giant getting destroyed. And if I say that, you probably know what I'm talking about right away. We had a wire photo of Bednarik standing over Gifford after he knocked him into next week. And it wasn't the iconic photo that everybody's kind of familiar with. It was a different angle and a different shot, but it was a Type 1 press photo of that hit.
Oh, man.
Wow.
And so that was number three. Number four was we have the Colts program from 1956 from Johnny Unitas' first start. And again, these aren't big dollar items, but it's cool as all get out.
That's unique. That's very unique.
And then I couldn't resist, and I went for a big dollar item for number five. We had the most stunning Walter Payton rookie I've ever seen. It graded a 9, and it's hard to grouse about a 9. But I had a lot of very knowledgeable people look at it and go, how on earth is that not a 10? But even as a 9, it did very well for us.
That's really cool. How long ago was that, Auger, with the
The Payton was, I want to say, about a year and a half ago now.
Oh, really cool. How long ago did you start Collector's Connection?
Well, I bought the company in January 1, 2018.
Okay.
And we changed the name, I guess, about 2 years ago.
Okay, right on. Congratulations. That's very cool.
So it's our fifth year doing it.
So stepping back earlier, I was like, it must be tough to load. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you?
Just one comment I want to make on the Unitas program. I still believe very strongly a lot of programs, paper materials, way overlooked in the hobby, especially in football.
I'd say more in baseball it started to catch up. In football it's still massively overlooked.
Media guides, programs, any type of paper material whatsoever in football is, to me, so undervalued right now it's not even funny. So here's a classic example. Somebody buys a Colts program for 1956, have no clue really of historical teams or anything like that, or who's playing where. So you open up and you start reading the program, and you see, you know, John Unitas in it, and you're saying to yourself, holy mackerel, is this really Unitas type of thing? And then they realize they have something of value and something historical at the same time. And
punchline on that particular item for us was the consigner didn't know it. We actually found it out because we check dates on everything we do, and we discovered that for them.
I believe it. Yeah, I mean, it's,
so you just thought
he knew it was a rookie year program, but he didn't realize it was actually the first start.
First start. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to me, and it's the same thing with ticket stubs. And the one thing I found interesting, again, making a reference to this last National, I had a lot of people ask me. They were looking more for Super Bowl ticket stubs and playoff ticket stubs, big bowl game ticket stubs, so on and so forth. It seems like overnight, the ticket stub area of the hobby is starting to really catch on fire. And again, a lot of it has to do with, and I had several conversations with these guys coming up and asking me, you know, the elimination of a ticket stub, everything's got to be on your phone now to get in to a game.
Yeah.
Is really, really wreaking havoc with that entire segment of the hobby. So
yeah, I mean, some of the smarter teams have come up with optional ways to get a stub, but yeah, it's definitely been interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really changed the whole aspect of that area of the hobby collecting. And again, I'm saying to myself, I've saved and bought and sold ticket stubs for over 50 years now, and to me it's just incredible to see where they're actually being appreciated, because now, in a way, it's too late because you're not seeing them for the past 3-4 years. So, but anyways, I wanted to make a comment on that Colts program, and again, you know, it's an overlooked area, is game programs and the historical value and the historical games that were played with them, so on and so forth. Really amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, even pointing out to the audience, and this was a few years ago now, it would do much better today, but even pointing out to our buyers what it was, it still only went for, I think, $60 or so.
Ooh,
oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, that market has definitely changed, you know, since we sold it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a tough one because you've got, you have to be a program collector. You have to be, you know, okay with vintage. I mean, I collect programs and ticket stubs of, you know, you know, things I'm interested in. You know, that's fascinating to me. I love that. That's, you know, Unitas' first game. I probably wouldn't take a stab at it because it doesn't fit my collecting, you know?
Right.
Yeah. We were talking earlier about how, you know, how anxious it must make you to hit send on that auction, you know, to upload it. And, you know, that is just fascinating, just, you know, how much work goes into the descriptions, into the photos, making sure they match.
And then the shipping when we're all done.
Oh, man, this is a small army of stuff. Man, literally we could do a show on just how hard that is. That's fascinating.
Having come from the live auction background, I can tell you it takes about five times as much man hours to do online as opposed to live.
Oh, really? Oh, well, yeah, that makes sense.
Because live, we show up and the stuff's all there. Everybody looks at it and we sell it.
Got it.
You know, there's no photography. There's no description writing. There's no shipping.
How do you find your auction items? I mean, you know, on the one hand, we just talked about what happens behind the scenes to make the auction happen, but then there's all of that army of effort to find the auction items, the amazing stuff for your auction. How do you do that?
There's a couple of different ways. Obviously just, you know, advertising and being out there. I do the National in Chantilly and Philly, and then I do a non-sport show, and I also do a comic book show. So obviously, you know, just being out and about, stuff comes in. We got some neat consignments at the National this year. Well, word of mouth from other consigners. Whenever I have a good experience with a consigner, I make sure that they know to, you know, tell their friends and all that good stuff. And then a lot of it, you know, I do get a lot of referrals. I've been in the hobby a long time, and so a buddy of mine will hear about something and know the guy who wants to sell, and he'll send them to me. And, you know, so a lot of it is just having been around and knowing people. But we set up consignment pickup trips. I in the last year and a half or so, I've gone out to the Midwest three times and plotted routes and made multiple stops along the way. My last stop, I actually started at Dallas, then went north to Chicago, then east through Indiana and Ohio down to West Virginia, and then home, and there was 14 stops on that trip. And so I publicized the trip, and then people schedule themselves if they're on the route. And my first stop on that trip was actually Dr. James Beckett.
Oh, wow, no kidding.
Yep, he actually consigned with us. It was very exciting. And we actually, I got a little bit of extra from him. I got the first issue of Beckett magazine signed by him while I was there.
That's really cool. What did he consign? I got it. He seems like a vintage football.
You know, not really supposed to go talking about that kind of thing, but let's put it this way. It was not, you know, it's just stuff. It's not, you know, anything earth-shattering or exciting. It's just like we all do. There's just excess stuff in the collection, and he's been a customer for a while, so.
Outstanding. Boy, are you allowed to put the provenance of an item in an auction where, like, this came from the personal collection?
The only thing we did that on was the autograph. We had two copies of Beckett Magazine autographed, issue one and issue two. So those are the only ones we talked about it, because it's really, you know, I don't know, I would just feel odd doing it. First of all, you'd have to have his permission to do it. You know, you wouldn't want to go telling about it, and it's like he didn't want anybody to know. And I don't know that. But you wouldn't do it without permission. So, no, the items are just listed as regular items.
No, that's interesting.
All right.
I used to take a little ad out in the football big book, and one year I would always get a copy of it, you know, sent to me. And I think it was edition 10 or whatever. I got it. And it was signed by him. And I was shocked when I opened up the book, and it had written Dr. James Beckett. So I still have that one. And that's pretty neat.
Oh, that's
just
cool.
To see him have his signature on it, so on and so forth. He's got to be up there in the years, I would say, right?
Yeah, but he's in phenomenal condition. I was joking with somebody, but I think he beat me at tennis right now.
Wow, cool.
That's neat. That's really neat.
Yeah, it was definitely a highlight for us. You know, it's like, I mean, I've talked with him a number of times, but to actually get to, you know, shake his hand and meet him and have him sign those was really cool. Because if you're of a certain age, he was the hobby.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. I want to back up one question, if I can. You said you had some major stuff in an upcoming football or upcoming auction you're having. Can you mention any of that stuff?
I would love to.
Okay.
Especially since there's a rumor going around that there's a Grange collector in the room, too. We have the Shotwell Grange complete set, and it's not the blank back version. It's the add back version complete. All SGC graded, and we're selling it as a set. We're not breaking it.
Incredible. That's a rare. Graded as a set. That's incredible. Great.
Yeah, we've only been able to find one other that's sold at auction, and it's been a number of years since one has come up.
Yep.
Then we also have a couple of the 1912 Olympiska Spelin postcards with Jim Thorpe on them. So he's not in football because he's actually, you know, at the Olympics, but it still definitely appeals to the football collectors. There's the famous one of him standing on the stairs in his uniform. But we also have the 1500-meter from the pentathlon. And that one actually graded a 6.5, which is the highest graded ever on that postcard by either PSA or SGC by quite a bit. The next highest is a PSA 5, and ours is an SGC 6.5.
Outstanding. Those are great.
I love those
postcards.
And then the last of the real biggies is we have a 1907 Pop Warner cabinet photo. It was actually from the collection of a guy who assistant coached with him at the Carlisle Indian School for 1 year. That's how they know how to date it to 1907. And the guy was on his staff for one season. And it came from his estate originally. So they go kind of neat to tie in with, you know, the Thorpe connection and everything else. But, you know, a 1907 football item isn't something you find all the time.
Just incredible. That's great.
And then, we have a nice run of sets. We have a 51 Bowman and some sport. We have all three of the big football sport kings. And there's a lot of great stuff. But those three are what I would consider special.
Well, the Shotwell's beyond rare, as far as I'm concerned, especially for an ad back.
Yeah.
And again, you know, I mean, they are rare of rare. It's amazing. Amazing that you got a complete set of them. So,
yeah,
and
it was a funny situation. It was a guy I actually helped. His family found them. There was a collector in the family who had passed, and they were going through stuff. And I kind of walked him. He wanted to get them graded. Normally, if people submit stuff to us raw that needs to be graded, we take care of it. But he wanted to do it, so I kind of walked him through the process, not realizing that he was actually looking to consign it. He just kind of called and was asking for help. And then when the time came, he's like, well, you helped me out. So there you are.
Wow. Unbelievable. Yeah, we talked about that briefly at the National, and I was curious about it. And I was like, wow, that's like a once-in-a-lifetime type of auction to come up. To see it as a complete set.
Yeah, and I mean, really, the fronts of them are generally speaking, super nice. So it presents well, even though obviously it's not a particularly high-grade set. The backs are rough, which is pretty common with those.
Who cares? SGC 10.
Yeah,
and
as I said, the front, you're going to think you're looking at X cars looking at the fronts of most of them.
Yes, without a doubt. It's usually the back. That's a great set. That's one of my favorite sets. Congratulations. That and the 1912 postcards, those are great consignments.
That was very exciting.
Hmm.
And like I said, this Shotwell Grange set is, you know, the phrase gets used a lot, but it really is new to the hobby. I mean, it was sitting in an attic 2 years ago.
And that is in your upcoming auction? Those are all coming up?
That's the one that starts on September 14th.
I got registered just in time, didn't I? When's that open up? It's for viewing right now, I think you said.
No, this is a different auction. We have one auction before that one. So the one that's running right now is not the one that's in.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
It's our next auction after this one that starts on September 14th.
Okay, great.
Wow.
Is that your pattern? Do you do one a month, or how do you?
It's not exactly one a month, but it works out to, you know, there are 12 a year. There's usually 10 days between them, and they usually run 18 days. There's a couple of exceptions, but it does ultimately work out to 12 a year.
Okay. Okay, very cool.
And we got one more question for you, Scott.
Sure.
Do you have any advice for beginning collectors?
Yeah, I was thinking about that, because actually I just posted to our website today, hype doesn't hold value. And I think that's the best advice I can give a collector. Don't go for what some influencer says is hot. Don't do something because you think everybody else is doing it. Do something because you love it. The money will follow. If the money is important to you, collect something good that you want to keep for a while. The money will follow. Don't chase trends. Don't believe YouTube. Find something that resonates with you. If it resonates with you, it will resonate with somebody else.
Well, I still maintain I should have bought plastic stocks about 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Because I would be sitting pretty right now. Because at the National, I was just shocked. I mean, I was in total shock seeing teenage kids with these little briefcases that have all their graded cards in it, and they would initially. There must have been about 50 kids that came the first 3 days. Are you buying anything? Are you buying anything? And Josh had to, you know, look at the stuff, and you know, it was pleasant, you know. You know, it wasn't like, you know, some dealers, no, I'm not buying anything, blah, blah, blah. But I'm just saying, I just can't believe how that really warped into that over the past 4 years or so. It's just crazy seeing those.
Yeah.
And, you know, the guys with the overstuffed backpacks trying to walk around with their cases at the same time, pulling out everything and trying to sell it one way or the other. It was tiring to watch after a while. And, again, as I said to a lot of people, I never saw so many $100 bills in my life in a concentrated area by young people. It was just really mind-boggling to me, really mind-boggling.
But the big question is, you know, where are they in 5 years?
Exactly. You know, What do you mean?
Will they stay in the hobby, Scott? Is that what you mean?
But will they stay in the hobby? Will the stuff that they made all the money on stay worth all the money? You know, kind of back to the whole don't chase the hype thing. Ultimately, I always joke, it's like the Florida real estate bust a few years back, where everybody's buying condos and flipping it to the next person who's flipping it to the next person who's flipping it to the next person. But ultimately, somebody has to want to live there.
Yeah.
And if it gets beyond the price of the person who needs to live there, then it has to correct. And that's how I feel about a lot of the hype cards right now, is they're just being flipped among people who are making money. There's got to be a guy at the end of the line who wants to own the card.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And that's what I wonder about with the hot and the trendy.
Yeah,
good
point.
It's not what I worry about
when it comes to 51 Bowman.
Somebody once told me that over half of all bidding in auctions is for other dealers who are buying kind of low-hanging fruit, you know, to put in their auction or to flip or something like that. Is that true in most auctions? And is that true?
I don't know what percentage it is, but I know I view my dealer customers as the safety net. You know, they keep stuff from going too low. Because if it goes too low, they're going to jump on it because they think they can turn around and make a profit on it. I always joke, you know, I love my dealers. I just hope I don't ever sell to them. You know, because I want the collectors winning, because they're, you know, I want to sell to the guy the dealer thinks he can sell it to. So, but like I said, they are a great safety net. I have a lot of, you know, a lot of well-known dealers who buy from us, and, you know, they absolutely help the bottom line, so.
That's cool. And I love that. That's a great way to put it. I love my dealer, you know, customers. I just hope I never sell them. That's a great way to put it. That's funny. So, yeah, good.
Yeah,
very good.
It's interesting. Very interesting. Scott, do you have any other closing thoughts or any other comments or any other?
No, just a little plug. If you do have something you want to consign or you want to talk to us about your items, you know, if you just need help figuring out what to do with them, it doesn't have to necessarily be for consignment. Just go to thecollectorconnection.com or give us a call, 717-327-8915, and 9 times out of 10, I'm the guy who's picking up.
Great.
That's
Our listeners, I touched on it earlier, but amazing customer service. I was having a hard time creating an account, and Scott stepped in personally, created my account, and just sent all they had to do was update my password. That's very rare in this industry. So I tip my hat to you, Scott.
No, I appreciate it. One of the things we thought of when we started the online version of the business was, let's correct all the things that bother me about bidding online. So hopefully we're doing a decent job of that.
Yeah.
That sounds good. I always say that what bothers you the most, you should not have it in your business at all, no matter what the business is.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Real good point. Good point. Well, Scott, thank you for being on today.
Thanks for having me.
Educational for us. And I can't wait to see that Shotwell ad back and where it ends up at. That's going to be pretty cool.
We're excited to have it. So.
Totally.
Great. Scott Russell of Collector Connection. Thanks for being on.
Thanks again.
All right, Joe, we've got a few extra minutes today, but we're going to I want to touch base on a couple of things. First, plug for the magazine, GridironGreatsMagazine.com. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? GridironGreatsMagazine.com. Check out our website. I want to go back, like I said, we've got a couple minutes here extra, and just briefly talk about that episode at the National that we looked at with regards to, the cases and stuff like that. So that brought up a good point, and it's something that's always I mentioned during the show to a few people that I was talking to. What happens if this whole bubble pops with graded cards? What happens if that PSA 10 that you paid $2,000 for is now only worth $200? What happens to the hobby? Does the hobby absorb it? What does the hobby do to respond to it? And I think it's a legitimate question. I really do. You got all the hype in the world there with the influencers and the YouTubers and everything else, and it just got tiring after a while listening and hearing it type of thing.
Yeah.
But the real question is, what happens? What happens when that card is worth 10% of what you paid for? Your thoughts on that?
That's the ultimate hot potato. I mean,
in all honesty,
I heard you talking about it, and I just heard Scott talking about it. It seems like it's a game of hot potato. Who's going to get left with it? I mean, everything in my collection is stuff I love. Regardless of the value of it. I mean, I want to collect stuff that doesn't lose value. I mean, you know, sentimentality only gets you so far. But you know, hearing your stories about kids walking into the National with briefcases practically, you know, walking up and, you know, I want 10,000 cash for this. And if you said no, then moving on to the next table, AKA, you know, sucker wannabe. It's weird. I hope our hobby isn't becoming that. I don't know. But like I said, it seems like a game of hot potato. Who's going to get stuck with this? You know, and Scott brought up a point I've never heard before. You know, this is only good as long as at the end there's someone who wants the card who's willing to pay what the dealer is going to buy for it is.
And I go back to something a longtime collector used to tell me way back when in the 80s, and he said, you only need one person to buy what you're selling. You don't need to worry about having 10, 15, 20 people buy it. You just need that one person who wants the item and let them buy it, and that's it. And that made a lot of sense to me back then. It makes a lot of sense to me now. But if there's, let's say, 100, LeBron James PSA 10 cards of the same brand, how is that really rare? And how is that really worth that much money? That's what I don't understand. I don't get it. Because he's hot, because he, you know, so on and so forth. So I have to pay $2,000 for that card. But what happens down the road if 99 people don't want the card anymore? What happens to the value of the card? Where does it go? You know, that's the problem. So I'm concerned. I'm very concerned with it. So
yeah,
I don't know.
I agree. And I think just recently we're starting to hear a little more about these bubbles, you know, about the kids who are flipping cars, you know, cards like you were mentioning, and or, I mean, you know, like I said, just what Scott just said. I never thought about it that way until he just mentioned that. There has to be an end user for it. I mean, and there's people coming, and we've been doing this a long time, Bob. There's always people coming and going from the hobby. All of us, you know, the majority of us collectors found our way back to the hobby the same way. We collected as a kid, we went away from it, and we came back to it. There's millions of other people out there who followed the same path, who hopefully someday will find their way back to the hobby. Will they collect the same stuff we do? Well, you know, larger cards, et cetera, or will they find something else? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, we're going to go into our two-minute warning. I'm going to hand off to you. What did you pick up on tonight's show?
Great guest. Very knowledgeable. It's I'm in the hobby. You know, people like Scott are in the business. I mean, and the difference is pretty cool. It just hearing somebody talking about how to put together an auction. And Al Crisafulli at Love of the Game, he and I have talked about what it takes to get a catalog out. And it's just headache that goes with that. So if you take a catalog plus an auction plus being out there trying to put consignments together, it reminds me of like the difference between a college football coach and a pro coach. I mean, the college coach has to recruit players and pander to parents to try and get, you know, young kids to play in his team. The NFL coach is like, you know, the general manager hires and fires people. It's a lot of work. That's got to be a tough grind. And it's got to be really tough to see amazing auction items get consigned and go, man, I would love that in my collection. But that's your job, is to sell them, you know?
Exactly. That's amazing.
Well, I got to compliment Scott. He is very customer orientated, and he is doing a very good job with his auctions. I've talked to several people who are very pleased with consigning with him and the results they got from it. So I wish him well in the future. Nice guy to talk to. Like I said, I got to talk to him briefly two times at the National, and it was very interesting. I can't wait to see that Shotwell add back go up and where he ends up at in his next auction. Well,
it's a lot of work to put that entire set together.
It'll be interesting to see what happens to him.
That's
about all I got. Joe, 10 seconds, final thoughts, if anything.
Great show, great guest, as always, Captain. It's great being your sidekick, talking football with Bob Swick. It's best seat in the house.
And it's always enjoyable to talk to you, Joe, about football. And I again have always said that football 365, 24/7, and everybody knows.
I love that.
Knows what that means. All right, we're out of time. Thanks for listening. Hopefully we'll be back next week with another show. Take care.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.